Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 4 of Greetings from Allentown. I am your host, Peter Winson, and we have a doozy of a show today. We will be looking at the WWF Superstars of Wrestling, February 7th, 1987, taped January 26, 1987, at the Sun Dome in Tampa, Florida, which is the home basketball court of the University of South Florida. And we got some big angles in this one. But in action, we have the Macho Man Randy Savage, the Mighty Hercules with Bobby the Brain Heenan, Killer Bees. We'll see Butch Reed come back around. We spoke about him in episode 1. And, there's a tag team title match between the Hart Foundation and the British Bulldogs, and Hogan and Andre meet up in Piper's Pit. But I'm sure you really don't care about that. You care about me getting in my plugs, which is, if you'd like to reach me via email, you can reach me at greetingsfromallentown@gmail.com. On Twitter, you can reach me at GFAllentownPod. And I'm posting there when the episodes go up, previews of what's coming up for future episodes. I also have a link somewhere in the feed in the last few days to a playlist on YouTube of all of the episodes that we have done so far. So, with all that in mind, let's get rolling. The opening contest this week is between the reigning Intercontinental Champion, the Macho Man Randy Savage, and he is facing off against David Gold, who, I'll clear the deck on David Gold here. He had 4 matches at 4 different television tapings in December of 86 and January of 87, and he lost all 4 of them. Adrian Adonis, Hercules, Jake the Snake Roberts, and this match against the Macho Man Randy Savage. Savage comes out to some very noticeable cheers, and even Jesse is pointing it out on commentary as he seems to be delighted at the fact that the fans have joined him in his advocacy of the Macho Man Randy Savage. Vince kind of tries to put a little stop to that, but you definitely notice during the course of this match that the crowd in Tampa is digging Savage, and I don't think it's because he's from nearby Sarasota. Savage, in 1987... you can take the Dos Equis guy and shove him, because Savage in 87 is the most interesting man in the world. Everybody knows about the feud with Steamboat, which started in November of 1986 when Savage busted up Steamboat's larynx, or larynx, as Jesse the Body pronounces it, by giving the double axe handle from the top rope to the floor onto the guardrail, and then later inside the ring with the ring bell. But he had much more than that going on. And he was so beautifully booked. He had so much going on at this one time. Of course, there was the feud, which had dated back to very early 1986, as they had a match at WrestleMania 2 against George the Animal Steele, who was forever infatuated with Elizabeth. And not only that, but Savage had a little feud with Bruno Sammartino. And they had a series of matches in the Northeast, and in fact, faced off in a lumberjack match on the night that this show aired at the Boston Garden, which Bruno won by disqualification. It's just amazing that a Bruno-Randy Savage series of matches happened. And that all started with the Ricky Steamboat angle in November of 86, where Bruno went backstage to interview Randy Savage about it, or to try and get an update. And Savage proclaimed that he was very proud of what he did. And Bruno, being Bruno, you slime, and he grabs him by the neck and puts him up against the wall, and chaos ensues. And it's a pretty fun match. It is on the network, this February 7th, 1987 show at the Boston Garden. I believe it may also be on YouTube as well. But I'll be referencing that show a little bit more as we go along. Savage throws Gold to the outside. He gets in all of his stuff. Double axe to the outside. Lands the big elbow. And then after the match, he channels his inner Kamala and decides, you know what? I think I'm going to go up to the top rope again. And he's talked down by the referee. But you can see the crowd in the background. There's like a couple of guys, probably about 10 rows up, who are motioning their arms. They're like, do it, do it, do it. And this is definitely a sign of things to come for Macho Man in 87. And we'll be covering more episodes of WWF Superstars and Challenge in 1987. But suffice to say that he almost had kind of a schizo summer. One night he'd be facing Hulk Hogan. Another night, maybe even the next night, he would be facing the Honky Tonk Man. Then the next night he would be facing the One Man Gang. Then he'd be facing Hogan again. He was almost alternating between face and heel on a nightly basis. He even had a match with Harley Race in Wichita, Kansas. And there was no real defined Randy Savage face turn. There wasn't a moment. It just sort of happened where people were cheering for him and Vince on commentary was willing to allow it and would actually acknowledge it. So Randy Savage, the most interesting man in the world for 1987.
A Silver Dome will accommodate over 90,000 people for WrestleMania 3. I'm also confident that a new world indoor attendance record will be set on Sunday afternoon, March the 29th. We just can't imagine anybody missing this, the biggest of all wrestling spectaculars. We're expecting fans from France, Germany, Africa, South America, the Orient, all over the world. Now for tickets to WrestleMania 3 in the Silver Dome, call area code 313-423-6666. Be part of history of the making. Be one of the 90,000 plus. Be part of WrestleMania 3 at the Silver Dome in Pontiac. For update, I'm Gene Okerlund.
WrestleMania 3, bigger, better, better.
And that is how the WWF announced that WrestleMania 3 would be held at the Pontiac Silver Dome. And it seems crazy in retrospect that it's February 7th, so it's a mere 7-8 weeks before the event, to announce that you're going to have it in this 80,000-seat football stadium. So for whatever you believe the attendance to be for WrestleMania 3, whether you buy the 78,000 number or the 93,173, truth is probably much closer to the 78,000. Part of the reason why they were able to get so many people in the building, other than, of course, the big main event, which we'll be getting to later on this show, is the fact that the pay-per-view was blacked out in the state of Michigan and in Southern Ontario. And Southern Ontario is a huge market for the World Wrestling Federation. If you look back the previous summer in 1986, they drew well over 60,000 people to Exhibition Stadium in Toronto, which was then the home of the Blue Jays, for the big event, which is on the WWE Network, and had a main event of Hulk Hogan versus Paul Orndorff. And Toronto was always one of the strongest cities for the WWF after they started running there in 1984. It's rather sad to see the state of the Pontiac Silver Dome these days, where it's not even a dome anymore. It's an open-air football stadium, as the roof has been basically torn off the place just due to lack of care. And the building, they keep talking like they're going to tear it down, but it just hasn't happened yet. But for any wrestling fan who looks fondly on WrestleMania 3, which should be just about everybody, it's going to be a sad day when that building goes.
I've had to work much harder than this, but something I want, don't try to resist me. Open your heart to me, baby. I hold the lock and you hold the key. Open your heart to me, darling.
next bout, we have the WWF Tag Team Champions, the British Bulldogs, taking on the Hart Foundation. And there is all sorts of backstory to this match. So I'm going to start on the Bulldogs side of the ledger, as they were the champs for about 10 months at that point, having won at WrestleMania 4 back in April of 86. And the Bulldogs were still a very, very good team, but at that point, they were not quite what they once were, and part of that was due to the fact that Dynamite Kid was breaking down. The big injury for Dynamite Kid occurred in Hamilton, Ontario, in a match against Bob Orton and the Magnificent Morocco, and it is on YouTube, so you can look it up, just Dynamite Kid injury, and it's the most simple, innocuous thing you'd ever see. He's just running the ropes. He jumps over the back of, I believe it was Orton, who went down face first on the mat, and he lands wrong as he leaps over Orton, and you can tell as he kind of hesitates and takes a step, and when he hits the rope, as planned, Morocco knees him in the back, which couldn't have been a more ill-timed thing since something just went in his back. And he could not work for quite a period of time as he underwent surgery. But they were very determined to drop the belts. Now, Vince McMahon had supposedly wanted them to drop the belts to Nikolai Volkoff in the Iron Sheik, who had already been tag champions in 1985, and they were going to go right back to them. But Dynamite and Davey Boy stood up for their pals, Bret Hart and Jim the Anvil Neidhart, and suggested that they should get the title. But we'll get to the Hart Foundation in a second. The editing on this match is very noticeable because you do not see the ring entrance of the British Bulldogs. But in the arena, Dynamite was literally carried to the ring on Davey Boy's back, as Davey Boy is also leading Matilda to the ring as well. So Davey Boy had to do a lot of work here. As for the Hart Foundation, they were never truly as pushed as people might remember. In fact, a lot of the time they were used as single wrestlers just to kind of fill out house show cards. As a matter of fact, Jim the Anvil Neidhart won the first WWF match of 1987 per the history of WWE.com, prevailing over Lanny Poffo in a show on January 1st in the opening match. But they never were really pushed too hard. It never really looked like they were going to get the tag titles as you looked at them through 86, because Bret Hart was also working singles matches himself, most infamously the never seen by anybody, it seems, match against Tom McGee at a Rochester, New York TV taping in October of 86. But here they are, and Dynamite Kid can't work, so to get around that, you have Jimmy Hart, who gets chased out of the ring by Matilda early on, runs around the ring and whacks Dynamite in the back of the head with the megaphone. Now, our referee here is Danny Davis, and hit this angle weaves in so perfectly because he had been playing the evil referee for quite some time. I brought this up in episode 1, where he was a referee in one of the matches there, but it was much, much more of a slow play at that point. He was favoring the heels. In this match, it was basically turned up to 11, his favoritism. Before this, he was the referee for the Saturday Night Main Event cage match between Paul Orndorff and Hulk Hogan for the WWF World title, or one of the two referees. He was the referee who decided that Orndorff hit the floor first instead of Hogan, while Joey Morella ruled in favor of Hogan, so they restarted the match then. And then, of course, they, as I mentioned in the first episode of Greetings from Allentown, Danny Davis was retconned as an evil ref because he was the referee when Tito Santana lost the Intercontinental title to the Macho Man Randy Savage back in February of 86. But right now, he's looks to be clearly aligned with Jimmy Hart. There had been kind of subtle allusions to that effect before this period of time. And Dynamite Kid is knocked out on the floor, and Danny Davis goes to check on him. And Vince is screaming, wondering why is he concerning himself with somebody who is not in the match. Meanwhile, we got a two-on-one in the ring between Hart and the Anvil, both in there at the same time against Davey Boy. But Davey Boy actually has the upper hand. This is only a three-minute match, but Davey Boy probably has the upper hand for about 2 minutes. Ends up whipping Anvil into Bret Hart. Bret Hart does the corner turnbuckle bump that he always does. And it doesn't look too bad, but of course the numbers game ends up prevailing, and they're able to nail Davey Boy while Davis is again out just kind of staring at Dynamite Kid on the floor, like kind of like as if Matilda had taken a dump and he's just kind of staring at it, waiting for somebody to come out with a bag and pick it up rather than pick it up himself. So Davey Boy finally gets conquered by the two Harts, and the Harts set him up for the Heart Attack move, which to me is one of the more underrated tag team finishers, just because of the way Bret Hart would throw himself into that clothesline, where he would go well into the air and would put everything he had into the clothesline. So I always really kind of bought that as a very strong finisher. And that puts Davey Boy away here, and we have new tag champions in a mere 2 minutes and 57 seconds as Vince is screaming bloody murder on commentary. Jesse is kind of like, ah, those are the breaks. But now the Hart Foundation are the new WWF Tag Team Champions. So finally, a push for Bret Hart, or so it would seem. And they would hold these belts until November of 1987 when the title change would happen again on Superstars, and they would lose to the newish team of Rick Martel and Tito Santana, Strikeforce. Danny Davis would go on to be fully aligned with the Hart Foundation, and he would be part of their six-man team at WrestleMania 3 to face off against the British Bulldogs, and somehow Dynamite Kid made that match and actually played face in peril for a while, which I'll never understand. And they were teamed with Tito Santana, the one that Danny Davis had also supposedly wronged. And Davis, of course, got the win in the match. But his career did not pan out quite so well after the initial point where Davis became a wrestler. He was actually suspended from refereeing the next week on Superstars for life by Jack Tunney. I always love how Gorilla Monsoon would add in that he was suspended for life plus 10 years, as if that meant anything, but it was always kind of a humorous thing by Gorilla. And Davis was actually part of a weird and definitely forgotten program with Mr. T in the summer of 1987. Mr. T was actually brought back to be the special enforcer of the World Wrestling Federation, and Davis had a problem with that, given his referee background. But that never really amounted to much. T made a few appearances on Superstars, giving a whatever rub he might have had left to the Young Stallions as they got one of their first big wins on television. But Danny Davis in the ring, he was never really all that strong. There was also the fact that a lot of wrestlers probably were not too thrilled to be selling for the guy who was on TV as a referee for the prior year. Davis always had he always looked like a prick. So the promo part of it, at least in terms of facial expressions he had down, he wasn't the greatest talker in the world, but if you have Jimmy Hart there behind you, you can probably get around that. I've always kind of wondered a way where they could have made the Danny Davis thing work. Maybe using the Hart Foundation as kind of his muscle or whatever, or at least have some vignettes where Bret Hart trains him to be a wrestler and kind of establish that instead of just throwing him into the ring, which is what they did. And he ended up kind of being a jobber for the remainder of his wrestling run, and then humorously enough would go back to being a referee in 1989, and they would acknowledge it on commentary as saying he was on probation, at least during the period in which he had just returned to refereeing. So they kind of did acknowledge an angle from 2 years before, which was rather unusual for that time period. The Bulldogs themselves, they would continue wrestling. As I mentioned, Dynamite Kid was at WrestleMania 3, and they would continue wrestling through the summer. And it's probably something where the Dynamite Kid should have taken time off, and he just really never did. And they kept on working, but never really got anywhere close to the tag team title picture, save for a brief run against Demolition after Demolition won the tag team championship at WrestleMania 4, before they would eventually leave the promotion at after Survivor Series 1988. There's a whole story in there with the Rougeau brothers and a sucker punch and teeth getting knocked out, but that's definitely a story for another time, I think. So, Hart Foundation, new tag team champions. For the next match, there's a promo backstage with King Harley Race, Macho Man Randy Savage, and Jimmy Hart in lieu of Adrian Adonis. And they're promoting the main event at the next Madison Square Garden show, which is an elimination match. Before Survivor Series ever came up for the WWF, you had on one side Savage, Adrian Adonis, and King Harley Race, and on the other side, Junkyard Dog, Ricky the Dragon Steamboat, and Rowdy Roddy Piper. And that is a very fun match, and I recommend you check it out. It's on the February 23rd Madison Square Garden show. And the promo is actually rather funny. Savage does his bit, and Harley Race just kind of standing in the background for much of the time, staring off into space. Not sure what he was up to there, but it's really, really fun. And to see all those guys together is quite I don't know, it's just a blast to see all those guys in the ring together. Anyway, less of a blast, we have here the Mighty Hercules taking on Buddy Blake. And Buddy Blake is another one of those guys who doesn't have a link to really anything. He's from St. Petersburg, Florida, so he gets a little bit of a cheer from the Tampa crowd, but all I can think is he's some sort of amalgam of Buddy Murphy and Wesley Blake, the former NXT Tag Team Champions in 2015, which, I don't know, I was thinking about them. They held the tag team title for longer than you might think, and then when they lost the title, they instantly became jobbers again. Like, literally, I believe the first match where they won the tag team titles was the first match that they had won on television. But this isn't the NXT 2015 show. This is the 1987 WWF show, and the not Mighty Hercules, he's just Hercules at this point. He's in that in-between period where he's not Hercules Hernandez, but they kind of keep saying Hernandez on commentary. And he was brought in, I believe, late 85. He was at WrestleMania 2. He lost to Ricky the Dragon Steamboat. And he was managed originally by Freddie Blassie. And Hercules would kind of get passed around. That was kind of something that happened to him. And he would only take offense one time, is when DiBiase tried to buy him as a slave in 1988, which cemented his face turn into the Mighty Hercules. But right now, he's Hercules, managed by Bobby the Brain Heenan, who had purchased the contract from the Doctor of Style Slick in late 1986, which, in November 86, Saturday night's main event, they kind of show a replay of how that went down, where Slick is demanding the payment in cash, and then he gives him the briefcase full of money. On that show, Hercules faced Hulk Hogan for the WWF title and had Hogan in the backbreaker, which is more commonly known as the human torture rack made famous by Lex Luger. He had Hogan in the rack and then just kind of let him go, doing the, oh, I think I won, because there's really no way for Hogan to Hulk up and get out of that particular move. That was always kind of Hogan's kryptonite, because he did give up to that hold against Lex Luger a couple times in the summer of 97 on Nitro, if you might remember. But Hercules, at this point, had given up that backbreaker finisher, which I don't understand why, because it was always a cool-looking finisher. It's a good power move. I think it's a little bit more... I think it comes off better than the Argentine backbreaker, which would later be used by Rick Rude and was previously used by the likes of Jesse the Body Ventura and also Bruno Sammartino. At this point, he was in a full Nelson phase because he's doing one of those Battle of the Full Nelson feuds with Billy Jack Haynes. And Hercules had a very strong start in 1987. He was fairly strongly pushed. He was a prominent member of the Heenan family at that time. Maybe not quite on par with Harley Race, but, you know, he was definitely not a forgotten man. And he was facing Billy Jack Haynes all around the horn at this point, doing a lot of draws. At WrestleMania 3, the two had a double countout finish, which you'd think, well, you know, nothing really happened there. Although Hercules did end up getting the upper hand by bloodying Billy Jack Haynes with a chain after the match, which, when you look back at WrestleMania 3, it's kind of shocking that you have this blade job taking place in the second match of the show, because that was very early on in the show. So Hercules kind of won that feud with Billy Jack Haynes, so kind of rare with the kind of decisive heel victory for Hercules there. After WrestleMania, he challenged Ricky the Dragon Steamboat for the Intercontinental title at Saturday Night's Main Event on May 2nd, but he would become part of Macho Man Randy Savage's Most Interesting Man in the World campaign, as Savage was all over that match in the vibe of, I don't want Steamboat to lose the title to you because only I should win the title back from Steamboat. And it was almost as if Savage was... they were teasing a face turn for him at that point. And Hercules was a little bit upset about this, but he ended up losing the match by disqualification there. And Savage came in and looked like he was going to help Steamboat, but then dropped the big elbow on him, which once again got some cheers as the Macho Man gradually evolved there. Hercules would not be so lucky in 87, as he was kind of a victim of Heenan family maneuvering. With Andre out of the picture in the summer, it kind of allowed him and Harley Race to step forward a bit. Paul Orndorff was also out of the picture as well, but replacing him in August would be Ravishing Rick Rude, making the jump over from Jim Crockett Promotions, where he was one half of the World Tag Team Champions with Manny Fernandez in the team Raging and Ravishing, which I think is just a fantastic name. And as Rude came in, and you had Bundy there, but Bundy was kind of just sort of floating around. He wasn't really doing much. I mean, he was in a match with Lord Littlebrook and the other minis at WrestleMania 3, for God's sake, so there wasn't too much there. He kind of got lost in the shuffle as we got towards the end of 1987, and that was something that would happen to Hercules for much of his WWF run. He would get a push, and then it would just kind of peter out, and nothing would happen. He had a little bit of a push after he turned face in 1988, but that never really went much of anywhere. He was the third mega power of all things, which is largely forgotten. It happened on the Brother Love show, where Savage came out and welcomed him as a brother and talking about seances and all that nonsense. But by the next summer, after having a WrestleMania victory over Haku, King Haku at that point, Hercules was in a feud with Dino Bravo, and you know what that means. That means you're pretty much going nowhere. And that feud really just fizzled on any level you can name. And Hercules was back to being a jobber, wearing the light blue tights that Honky Tonk Man always talks about. When you wear the light blue tights, it's a sign that your career is definitely on the decline. So Hercules, in the middle of 1990, turns heel along with Paul Roma and forms Power and Glory. And they had that great Powerplex finisher. But unfortunately, their push just seemed to kind of fizzle out too. There's an interview with Paul Roma on a recent Steve Austin show, and I recommend you listen to both parts of it. It's a very good interview, and he kind of talks about what happened with Power and Glory. I think it should be taken with a grain of salt, but I think that there was something there with Power and Glory, and Hercules seemed to be a guy who was very well liked backstage. Paul Roma definitely looked towards him as a mentor, but his career was just kind of full of fits and starts. He was never a particularly great worker. He wasn't really a good talker, but he did hang around for an absurdly long period of time. Anybody who's ever listened to the OSW podcast, and I have, they would constantly talk about how Hercules would end up on every single pay-per-view from 1985 all the way through the 1992 Royal Rumble. He's there for just about every... I can't think of one pay-per-view where Hercules is not there. I think he's there as a substitute in Royal Rumble 92, but he is still there. But at this point here, he still had some momentum, and he puts away Buddy Blake pretty quickly with a full Nelson. So, onward to WrestleMania 3.
Mate, watch me wallabies feed. They're a dangerous breed, mate. So watch me wallabies feed. All together now, tie me kangaroo down, sport. Tie me kangaroo down. Tie me kangaroo down, sport. Tie me kangaroo down.
Vince McMahon is often accused of being completely out of touch with culture or being 5 years behind. Like he'll hire something or start a storyline that would have been cool in 2012, but will wait until 2017. Well, that was not always the case, as right now we have the much-awaited debut of Outback Jack. So a little background on how Outback Jack came to be. In September of 86, a movie came out starring Paul Hogan, at least in the United States. It came out much earlier in Australia, called Crocodile Dundee, where an Australian guy ends up, played by Paul Hogan, ends up in New York City. It was a huge hit in the United States, and there was a great interest in Australian culture at that point. So the WWF signs Peter Stillsbury, a wrestler out of Victoria, Australia, or not really even a wrestler. It was just something that kind of was thrown together. He was 6'5", 300 pounds, and I guess they decided they liked the look. And he was sent to the Stampede territory because he was incredibly green at that point and really not fit to be put on WWF television. And it was getting pushed back and pushed back and pushed back before his debut on this show. And there were weeks of vignettes of him drinking beer in Australia and, you know, doing other stuff and like a, driving around in a Jeep. And it felt like, you know, it wasn't quite at that Glacier level where, you know, the vignettes were running on and on, but it felt like, oh dear God, I mean, when the hell is this guy gonna show up here? Well, he finally does show up here, and he's actually introduced by Hillbilly Jim, which, no disrespect to Hillbilly Jim, another guy who was given quite a lengthy build and never, I mean, he was a likable character for many years, but Hillbilly Jim was very hot in late 84 and early 1985. He was very over with the fan out of the crowd gimmick, which he was brought in under. And he was in, but he got injured in 85 and never quite got back the steam that he had lost there. So right here, he's out to introduce Outback Jack instead of Howard Finkel, probably because everybody loved Hillbilly Jim, so they'll be sure to applaud Outback Jack. Jesse Ventura can't get over the fact of how ugly Outback Jack is. He's not a particularly attractive character, missing more than his share of teeth. He's facing off here against Steve Lombardi. Now, Lombardi was known for many years as being kind of the ultimate enhancement talent. He's been thrown out there since about 1983-84, facing baby faces, heels, whatever you needed him to do. Consummate company man. Early 1987 was probably the midst of the second biggest push that Lombardi would ever get, for whatever a push was worth for Lombardi. Of course, the most famous is his early 1989 run as the Brooklyn Brawler, where he even had Bobby Heenan as his manager for a very brief period. That run did not last too long past WrestleMania 5, but he was able to keep the Brawler name, so he was kind of a jobber with a gimmick, which is rather unusual at that point. He also was in a feud with Paul Roma, which would actually culminate in the dark match at WrestleMania 3. So the first people through the curtain that night were Paul Roma, there's that name again, and Steve Lombardi, two longtime enhancement talents at that point, leading off the biggest show in World Wrestling Federation history. And Lombardi, you can see here, is really trying to hold this match together and trying to deal with how limited Outback Jack was. He's not quite the Great Khali, but he's not much better than that. I mean, he can do a body slam, he can do a clothesline. They do a little bit of like a hammerlock and reversal sequence early. I was not particularly convincing, but a lot of this is Lombardi running in to Outback Jack. For a match where the guy has his debut, he's not getting in a lot of offense. Lombardi probably has about 40 to 50% of the offense, which you would not expect in a match like this. Outback Jack had a lot of heat backstage. I don't know if it was the vignettes or what, but there are shoot interviews out there. I listened to one recently with the Honky Tonk Man, and of course everything he says, you know, consider the source. Well, Outback kind of thought he was hot shit, which is kind of weird in that, you know, he was as ugly as Jesse Ventura says he is here. And he kind of got a big head. And soon enough, he wasn't beating anybody. He was losing to Ron Bass. And he was not getting wins over anybody. He was not on the Survivor Series 1987 card, which was kind of unusual for somebody who was given the kind of introduction he was. He's not even in the picture by late 1987, other than to lose to more famous wrestlers on TV. He did have the Killer Khan mist blown in his face, and there was a bit of an issue there where he had two televised matches with Killer Khan, as Khan was in for his summer program with Hulk Hogan. Outback would get apparently ribbed mercilessly because he was just not well liked backstage. I guess they shaved his eyebrows and, you know, all the usual stuff that you would do to a new guy, but in fact they were even more merciless to the old Outback man. In fact, he was called Outhouse Jack by a lot of people, which is probably one of the better derisive nicknames you could give a guy. He would hang around into 1988. Yes, he also had an LJN figure, which I don't know if this is becoming a staple of this show where I talk about the LJN figures, because everybody cares about the Jax figures and the Hasbro figures, but as I do this show right now in my basement studio, I'm actually looking right now at one of my LJN figures, which is a Bruno Sammartino LJN, and he's there with Ric Flair. Not to get too far off track here, but when I had a party at my house during the Super Bowl when Atlanta was way out in front in the game, a couple of my friend's kids, they wanted to watch wrestling. So I'm like, here, you know, and I put on the 1993 Royal Rumble because, oddly enough, they didn't know who won the 1993 Royal Rumble and were going to be surprised, which is funny because that's one of the critiques is like, well, there's nobody else who could have won but Yokozuna. Well, I couldn't find any of my figures, so I gave them the Bruno LJN and the Ric Flair one that I also keep in front of me here that has the weird red thing that sticks out the back. I'm not exactly sure what that's supposed to do. I mean, I know I'm getting way off the Outback Jack track here, but I told them to try and put a match together between Bruno and Ric Flair because they would be the first to really accomplish something workable there. Back to Outback Jack, finally. He hung on through the early part of 1988, and the last televised match he would have is actually a rather interesting footnote in that he was part of a six-man team facing off against the Islanders, as the Islanders were having their only match as a six-man unit. Haku, Tama, and Sivi Afi, who was rechristened as High Chief Afi, and got a lot of tattoos in anticipation of this. And then they decided to call the whole thing off when Tama got fired shortly thereafter for being just kind of, I guess, generally unreliable. Outback's teammates on that day were Brady Boone, who would later go on to be the first Battle Cat, and another man by the name of Steve Blackman. And yes, it is that Steve Blackman. Before he got sick in 1989, he was out of commission for quite some time. Steve Blackman was an enhancement talent in late 80s WWF. And of course, he would go on to accomplish somewhat great things during the Attitude Era, things such as shoving Shane McMahon off a Titantron. Yeah. But as for Outback Jack, I'm wondering, and I'm going to throw this question out there. You can respond to me on Twitter at GFAllentownPod or greetingsfromallentown@gmail.com. Has there ever been a wrestler who had a series of vignettes who made so little impact on his arrival? I'm thinking maybe Curt Hawkins on the current iteration of SmackDown. There were some vignettes kind of giving him the Chuck Norris treatment, and I don't think he's really done anything. But if there's anybody else who's done vignettes, I mean, when you think of great vignettes, you think of Mr. Perfect, you think of Ted DiBiase, you think of the Dusty Rhodes vignettes. These vignettes didn't really do anything, and neither did Outback Jack, as it turned out, in his brief year and a half run in the World Wrestling Federation. And now it's time for perhaps the most famous Piper's Pit, where nobody gets hit with a coconut, and probably even more famous than that. We have Roddy Piper and Jesse Ventura, who have both promised to bring their man to Piper's Pit to talk things out. And that would be Hulk Hogan and Andre the Giant. Now let's go back to 86 and talk about where Andre was, because like Piper and like Ventura, Andre was at WrestleMania 2, winning the Chicago portion's Battle Royal with all the NFL players. And he took off because he was not really in any sort of condition to work a regular schedule. He worked with Akira Maeda in Japan in a rather infamous shoot match that, well, it turned into a shoot, where Maeda just kind of kept kicking his legs because Andre, I guess, was drunk and uncooperative, which I suppose you can be if you were a guy his size. He did come back to the WWF in the summer, mainly to work the machines angle, which started with Andre being suspended by President Jack Tunney at the behest of Bobby the Brain Heenan for, quote, no-showing a scheduled tag team match against Big John Studd and King Kong Bundy. So what happens is, all of a sudden, this new team from Japan, the Machines, which was a ripoff of an existing group of machines in Japan, in reality, it was actually Blackjack Mulligan as Bill Eadie, who would later go on to be Demolition Axe, was Super Machine, a kind of wink and a nod to his days as the Masked Superstar. And Big Machine was none other than Blackjack Mulligan. And the third member of the Machines was Andre the Giant. And it was pretty clearly Andre under the mask, but they would never really have him talk. There was one instance where he did talk, and you pretty much left no doubt. But hilariously, the babyface announcers like a Monsoon or whoever would kind of leave it up in the air. Well, it could be Giant Baba, which is entirely laughable, because if you've ever seen Giant Baba, they have two completely different bodies. I mean, Andre is definitely a lot thicker, but nevertheless, the Machine's angle kind of ran its course. It was not particularly successful, and Andre wasn't even really a big part of it. Most of the time, he wasn't even in the matches. It was either a tag match with him at ringside, or he just wasn't there at all. Eventually, they just started subbing in random other machines, such as the Piper Machine, the Hulk Machine, the Animal Machine, and you can figure out who those guys were. So Andre kind of faded out there for a while, and he was still, quote, under suspension in storyline. When we get to November, Jack Tunney comes on WWF television and announces that Andre the Giant has been reinstated effective immediately. What I can tell you is that Andre was not at the hearing, and Bobby the Brain Heenan was. And that was definitely designed to add intrigue to it, because it would make you think, well, why the hell was Andre reinstated if he wasn't there and Bobby Heenan was? And if you could really read between the lines of that, you could perhaps see what was coming down the road. So later on, Andre does an interview from London with some dude from, I believe it was Sky, when I think they were in their infancy. I can't remember the guy's name. And he just says, it's great to be back. At this point, Jesse the Body, who plays a larger role than might be remembered in all of this, he decides he smells a rat. So he's on TV, and he vows to get to the bottom of this, and he asks Andre what's going on. And Andre tells him that it's none of his business. And Jesse's just kind of backs off there for a bit. But it seems like, you know, something is definitely afoot. Jesse was definitely on to something, and it made him look very smart, as it turned out. At least, you know, he made the character look smart. So we jump ahead, and Andre was actually supposed to return to the ring for a January 3rd, 1987 show at the Meadowlands in New Jersey. It was a television taping, and there was to be a dark match main event where Andre would team with Hulk Hogan against the Honky Tonk Man and Macho Man Randy Savage, which is a most interesting team. There's a promo out there of Hogan and Andre promoting this match, which got scratched as Andre was subbed out in favor of Ricky the Dragon Steamboat. And that match is available on YouTube. I believe Richard Land's YouTube channel has the entire January 3rd, 1987 television taping. It's very interesting to watch because it has the taping in order from start to finish, because of course it ended up as episodes of Superstars through the course of January, but it also has the dark matches as well, which ended up being international exclusives or whatnot. Now, January 17th, 1987, on the Piper's Pit, there's a giant trophy out on the stage, and it is awarded to Hulk Hogan for being WWF champion for 3 years. They were nearing the third year anniversary of his title win. He comes out, he makes his usual speech, and Andre the Giant comes walking out. And all he says is, 3 years to be a champion is a long time. And then he just turns around and leaves. I'm like, okay, that's a little weird. Next week, we have another trophy presentation out there. And this one is going to Andre the Giant for being undefeated for 15 years, which is not entirely true. In the WWF canon, he perhaps was undefeated, never pinned or never submitted during that time. But he had, in reality, several losses, including to Antonio Inoki earlier. I believe it was in 1986. But put it this way, Andre had lost matches during that time. So he's awarded a trophy, and it's a smaller trophy than what Hogan had gotten the week before, and it's certainly noticeable. They were both very large trophies. There's no question about it. But Andre's trophy was definitely smaller. And during the presentation, Andre doesn't get to say anything, and Hogan just comes marching out and gives a fired-up speech saying that Andre the Giant is number one in WWF, blah, 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 blah. And then Andre just turns around and leaves, which was probably the right thing to do, because I'd be a little pissed off if somebody was giving me an award and then somebody came. Hogan, that was really probably the inspiration for the the Kanye West interrupting Taylor Swift at that award show. It's like, we give this award to you, Andre, and then Hogan is up there. I'm going to let you finish, but Andre the Giant is the greatest of all time. Well, you know, that's probably the only time you'll ever hear a comparison with Hulk Hogan and Kanye West. But so the next week, Jesse Ventura smells a rat, and he goes on Piper's Pit and says he thinks that his sources are telling him something's afoot. He doesn't know what, but he decides we should get Hulk Hogan and Andre the Giant together. And he vows, he says that Andre owes him a favor, which I've always wondered what the nature of that favor was that Jesse did for Andre. Maybe probably got a couple barrels of wine for him, a couple cases of, you know, beer, who knows. And he asked Roddy Piper to go get Hogan for the following week, which was interesting in the way they did that, because at the end of the show, they show Piper in the dressing room asking Hogan to come back on the show next week. And again, they always had the kind of the underlying tension between Hogan and Piper there. Yes, they did tag up on shows around this time, but you know, they were not playing grab ass with each other all of a sudden, which is good. I like the fact that they kind of kept something there where, yes, these guys were enemies. They did face off in the first WrestleMania. So they vow to bring Andre and Hogan, but there would be a surprise guest on this day. They come out, they argue, and Piper says, I got my man, and Hulk Hogan comes out. And Jesse says, he's impressed, but he don't impress easy. And he starts into the introduction for Andre, and he does the 7'4" and Q. You look at the doorway there, Bobby the Brain Heenan comes walking through. And the crowd for this, it's very interesting. I mean, they were generally much quieter and more respectful. They'll listen to what Piper had to say in these segments, but they went deathly quiet when Bobby the Brain walked out onto that set. And Andre is behind him, and poor Andre, you know, he's a huge dude. He can't get good clothes or anything like that. He can't get a jacket that buttons all the way around because he has trouble trying to button it at one point. And part of the reason for that is he's got basically sweats. He's either got sweat stains on his tits or he spilled something and then, but he can't change his shirt because he probably only got one shirt, because where the hell are you going to get an 8XL shirt, you know, on short notice if you spill something? So Andre's got like what looks like sweat stains over his breast area, and he stands there next to Heenan, and Hogan is beside himself. And Hogan, not the greatest actor in the world, he does his best here with the, what are you doing with him? What? You're the one who taught me about respect for the fans, to do things for the kids. And Heenan, at a point, interrupts and says, I am so sick of what you've done. You've laughed behind this man's back. You never once offered him a title shot. To which Hogan interrupts, but never says, oh, I did offer him a title shot, because it's the truth. The actual truth is, if you go back, there's an interview somewhere on 1984 WWF television where Andre is asked why he doesn't want to go for the world title. And Andre says, I'm just happy being the giant. So that was kind of something that stood. I mean, he was definitely, of course, the special attraction and didn't need a title or anything like that. So Hogan is so distraught here that he actually grabs the lapels on Andre's, you know, as kind of a, Andre, please, please, this can't be happening. And Andre, take your hands off of my shoulders. It's very hard to understand what Andre was saying. It's, I don't know how much they looped his Princess Bride dialogue, because of course that was another big part of his 1986, was going over to Europe and filming the Princess Bride as a Fezzik the Giant, one of Wally Shawn's henchmen in that film. It's I love the Princess Bride. And Andre probably maybe the best wrestler performance in a movie. I don't know. I do like Terry Funk in Roadhouse, but I digress here. So Andre has definitely established himself. Take your hands off of me. And Heenan says he's here for one reason. And Andre says, I'm here for one reason, to challenge you for a world championship match at WrestleMania. And Hogan, this can't be happening. This can't be happening. And he's actually doing a good job expressing fear that he doesn't want to face Andre. He thought we're friends. We're friends, Andre, please. And Heenan with the money line, you don't believe it? Maybe you'll believe this, Hogan. And Andre grabs the Hulkamania shirt and tears it off him. Not the traditional way that Hulk would tear his shirt off. And along the way, he grabs Hulk's crucifix on him and rips that off as well. Ends up scratching Hogan on the chest, and the trickle of blood is going down. And Piper can't resist saying, you're bleeding. Which I'm sure Vince was thrilled about, you know, the pointing out that, hey, everybody, there's blood on Saturday morning TV. It was an accident, and of course they weren't going to reshoot the angle for it. And in retrospect, it was a beautiful thing that happened. It was actually rather serendipitous because of the symbolism of him ripping off the cross and then cutting Hulk Hogan, albeit a little bit, on the chest. And that, my friends, is how you fill a football stadium for your big show. It's as simple as you take a world champion and you have him hold the belt for 3 years, and then you take another guy and you build him up to the point where you can plausibly say, oh, he has not lost for 15 years, and you have the undefeated guy turn on the champion. It's money every time. It's just good science. Hogan did not actually accept the challenge here, so this would be kind of a talking point. I feel bad because there are still two more matches on this show, and how the hell are you going to be able to follow this? But what will happen is Hogan will have to come back on to Piper's Pit the following week, and in his usual subtle fashion, as Piper is trying to get an answer out of him, Hogan would say, yes, in response to the challenge of Andre the Giant. So we're off and running. Try to fill that Pontiac Silverdome for WrestleMania 3. Right after this, trying to follow that Piper's Pit, we have the Killer Bees in action, facing off against Jimmy Jack Funk, who we covered in episode 1, and Al Costello. And I'm a little obsessed with Al Costello right now, because I did a little research into him. He's not even really, maybe not even the most famous jobber named Costello in WWF, because there was another one, Brian Costello, that you would see come along later. Al Costello is announced as hailing from Boston. Now, I don't know the veracity of that. I can't check that because there's almost no information. I want to find out, is he from, like, Jamaica Plain? Is he from West Roxbury? Where's he from? No idea. Al Costello was a veteran TV jobber in WWF, dating from 1985 through 1988, and according to his data on Cage Match, had an 0-24 record overall, working mostly tag matches with a veritable who's who of fellow jobbers, teaming up with guys like Iron Mike Sharp, Joe Cruz, Tiger Chung Lee, although I would hesitate to call him a jobber because Tiger Chung Lee is freaking awesome, Joe Murto, Gino Carabello, Moondog Spot, and of course, the leader in the clubhouse, Steve Lombardi. But there was one match that really jumped out to me. On house shows, you would often see two jobbers put against each other. It would often be something along the lines of SD Jones versus Iron Mike Sharp. And it would kind of be an indication of, all right, well, we're going to give a guy a win because, you know, we really like what they've been doing or whatever. There's a match from Birmingham, Alabama, November 16th, 1986, where Costello faces off against Don Driggers, a fellow jobber. And unfortunately, Don Driggers got the win there. The only win he would get in the WWF in about, I think it was 20 matches. So poor Costello ends up 0-24 for his career, which wrapped up in October of 1988 at a Wrestling Challenge taping, losing to Tito Santana in singles action. But don't worry, Al. As the Bible says, the meek shall inherit the earth, I guess. So the Killer Bees, who are our stars here and had to follow Hogan, Piper, Ventura, Andre, Heenan. I am not a fan of B. Brian Blair, but I'm not going to go into the Iron Sheik bit because I was never really a fan of that whole, make them humble. It just seems like kind of a Johnny One Note kind of comedy deal there. I don't like Brian Blair because I find him to be one of the most boring wrestlers I've ever seen. Last summer, in 2016, I watched WWF TV in 1984 every morning before work, and whenever a Brian Blair match would come on, I would just immediately zone out. It was just incredibly boring. I'm sure he's a nice guy and all, but anybody who uses an abdominal stretch into a roll-up as a finisher, that's boring even for 1984. In the spring of 1985, Jumpin' Jim Brunzel, well, jumps out of the AWA, where he was teaming with Greg Gagne as the High Flyers, and comes into the WWF, and upon the suggestion of Hulk Hogan, close friend of Brian Blair, dating back to their days in Florida, they both trained under Hiro Matsuda, the idea was to maybe team these two guys together in a team that was called the Killer Bees, which, a play off their last names, I guess. There was also a defensive unit of the Miami Dolphins called the Killer Bees because there was about three or four players whose names started with B. And of course, much later, you would have the more famous Houston Astros with Bagwell, Berkman, and Biggio. But this Killer Bees kind of were a staple of the mid-card tag scene in WWF from their start in 85 all the way up to when they disbanded in 1988. And 87 is probably their most interesting year. They was definitely very up and down. At this point, they were heading into a WrestleMania match with the Iron Sheik and Nikolai Volkoff, which they would lose by disqualification due to the interference of Hacksaw Jim Duggan. They're fondly remembered for the mask thing, which they would do. They would put on the mask because they kind of looked alike in terms of body shape. And that is very much a heel thing to kind of do, but it was one of those things where people cheered it because it was one of those, ha-ha, they got one over on the bad guys there, which was fine, but they never quite got over that hump. Although during this time period, in Toronto in March of 1987, there was a tag team tournament. The Frank Tunney Sr., who was the promoter for many, many, many years in Toronto area, it was a Frank Tunney Sr. tag team tournament, and the Killer Bees actually won that tournament, prevailing in the finals over Demolition, which was kind of surprising to see because Demolition, I didn't recall them ever really losing much up to their time winning the tag team titles at WrestleMania 4. Now, in the summer of 87, the WWF instituted cocaine testing, or at least a drug testing policy where they tested for cocaine. They sure as hell weren't testing for steroids. We know that, at least at that point in 87. And Jake the Snake Roberts got popped on that drug test, which, if you know anything about Jake Roberts' career, is no surprise. And according to Bret Hart's book, Jake went to the office and said, "Hey, how come I got popped? I was doing the stuff with Brian Blair." So they suspended Brian Blair. And I'm not sure of the veracity of this. I've never seen anything that was, well, Brian Blair was suspended. But if you look at the Killer Bees results, anywhere you look, they disappeared for 30 days in the middle of the summer. So kind of going to say if there's a little fire behind that smoke there. And you really wouldn't hear too much from the Killer Bees again until that odd Survivor Series tag match. It's a very good tag match, the 10-team, 20-man elimination match at Survivor Series 1987, which doesn't hold a candle to the one from the year after, where the Killer Bees were actually the survivors in the match, along with the Young Stallions, which was rather unusual booking, if I may say so, considering that neither team was particularly pushed at any point after that, and you had the tag champion Strikeforce in the match, you had Demolition, you had the Islanders. There was a lot of teams in there that were, you would consider, above the two teams that ended up surviving the match. This match here is just kind of a background player so that Vince and Jesse and Bruno can talk about what happened with Andre and Hogan, and it's pretty harmless. It reminded me a little too much of that Patriots match we saw on the episode last week of Greetings from Allentown, where the Patriots were working the arm for a very long time. The Bees here are working the arm quite a bit on both Navarro and Funk, and they end up getting the win in the end. Poor Navarro has to take the pin here with that great Jumpin' Jim Brunzel Okada dropkick. It's so weird that when you take the great dropkicks of all time, if you were to rank the top five, right now, it's Kaz Okada who has the great dropkick in all of wrestling right now. But Jumpin' Jim Brunzel, by any standard, has a top five of all-time dropkick. And it's not like this guy ever was in contention for a world title or anything. It's just so happened that the guy was excellent at throwing dropkicks. Just watch this. It cannot be denied. Poor Brian Blair, though. He still bores me to death during this match. He bores me like Milton bores Donald Sutherland's character in Animal House. I really, really just can't take it. I might have to start screening for Brian Blair matches on future episodes. So after this match, we're going to throw it to the back where Craig DeGeorge, yes, he is there at this point, the proto-Sean Mooney. Craig DeGeorge is there, and he's trying to make sense of this whole scene post-Piper's Pit.
Vince, there's a state of confusion here backstage. As you can hear, people are mumbling and buzzing around about what's going to happen. Perhaps Bobby Heenan can tell us. Bobby can't tell us. We're going to try and get an update for you, as we have been trying to do all along. Bobby Heenan could perhaps... Gene Okerlund.
Yes.
Gene, right. Could you please tell us the situation?
I'll be right there.
Hulk Hogan, Andre the Giant, what is the state of mind now for the champion?
Hulk Hogan, heavyweight champ, is psychologically totally deflated. It's like he has had a dagger stuck in his heart. I don't know what to make of it. We're going to try to sort it out, and I'll get the information to fans as soon as possible.
All right, Gene, have you ever seen? We'll try and get more on the situation. Back to you, Vince.
Right now we have the natural Butch Reed making his second appearance on Greetings from Allentown, facing off against David Stoudemire, not Damon Stoudemire, the point guard, former point guard for the Toronto Raptors. He's making his WWF jobber debut here, and he would actually do two better than Al Costello. He would go 0-26, almost as if he was working a Tampa Bay Buccaneers 1976-77 gimmick. Never even came close to winning during roughly the same time frame as Costello, working from here in 87 up through very early 1989. There's not too much notable about his career other than what happens in this match. So we have the natural with the Doctor of Style, Slick. And Slick, it wasn't quite the same before he got the Jive So Bro music. I mean, there was no dancing in the ring. I mean, when you think of Slick, you think of maybe his promos, but you think of Jive So Bro and him doing that dancing thing in the ring with the arms, the way Akeem used to do. So That's kind of missing here. I'm glad that that'll be coming along soon. Coco Beware is there to cut an insert promo on Natural Butch Reed as they wonder whether Butch Reed will be on WrestleMania 3, and if Coco, who's been rising through the ranks, would be there at WrestleMania 3. I hope to God they didn't do this match because, oh, Butch Reed is a black guy and Coco's a black guy, so let's put them together in the same match, because I really hope that they just didn't do that. That would be really, really bad, even by the standards of the day. Now, in this match, which is a very, very quick one, Butch Reed, who in the first episode I had said that his finisher was a clothesline off the top rope, which is not entirely accurate because Reed used a lot of different moves as a kind of finisher. Here, he gets Stoudemire in a gorilla press and drops him. It's exactly the same as what the Ultimate Warrior would come to do, except poor Stoudemire, I don't know if he was green or if Reed dropped him wrong, ends up falling almost entirely on his face. So that did not end well for Mr. Stoudemire. And then Reed throws an elbow, bouncing off the rope, throws an elbow and gets the pin there. And then instead of going for the pin, does the, you know, 1 foot cover, also a la Ultimate Warrior on Macho Man Randy Savage at WrestleMania 7. But wait, there's more. Slick gets on the microphone after the result is announced and just challenges Coco Beware, because that's how you start an angle. You just have the manager call out a challenge and here, we're going to have a match at WrestleMania. And that's exactly what happened, and Reed did win that match against Coco Beware in the Pontiac Silverdome. Right after this match, they cut to an interview in the backstage area, and I don't always like to cover the local promos that you'll see on this show. This one is, again, for Madison Square Garden, but I do want to note that the promo is with Demolition, who was still managed by Luscious Johnny V at this point, and Axe and Smash come out, and at this point, Smash had been replaced by Barry Darsow. Darsow was now in the role replacing Moondog Rex, I believe it was, Randy Colley, as it were. And if you look at their face paint is completely different from what you would see later on. Axe's hair isn't quite slicked back as much. Darsow's hair is not there because he was fresh off his run as Crusher Khrushchev in Jim Crockett Promotions, where he was shaved bald because he's portraying a Russian. So he's moved from Russia to parts unknown. They would start their great run. It would take them a while to get going, but of course they would win the tag titles in 88 and then set the record for longest tag title reign until it was broken by the New Day in 2017 in what is just incredibly bullshit fashion and due to politics and whatnot, but yeah. That'll do it for this episode of Greetings from Allentown. Your feedback will be accepted happily on Twitter at GFAllentownPod, via email at greetingsfromallentown@gmail.com. Next week, I'll be heading to the Caribbean on vacation, but we will still have a show here on Thursday as usual, and we'll be jumping into 1992, just ahead of the Royal Rumble. And we'll be staying in the World Wrestling Federation, as you might have guessed. January 12th, 1992 episode of Wrestling Challenge. So we're going to be peeking in with Gorilla and the Brain for the first time. And on this episode, we have two men, Sean and Marty, meeting up in the barber shop to have a little talk. I wonder if anything might happen there. Do tune in, won't you?